come here in search of something else. Someone else. A name from his past. Massive chunks of his memory were still missing. To fill in the gaps, he'd need to speak to someone who had been there with him during that time. Someone who had served beside him in the war. Malak had been his right hand during the campaign against the Mandalorians. But Malak was dead. Revan would get no answers there. Yet there had been another. A powerful Jedi named Mitra Surik. Mitra had been among the first to join Revan's cause, and she quickly proved herself to be a brilliant tactician and military leader. Recognizing her potential, Revan had made her a general, giving her control over nearly half of the Republic and Jedi troops under his command. Mitra had been instrumental in defeating the Mandalorians, dealing them a devastating blow during the Battle of Malachor V, though at a cost nearly impossible to fathom. He hesitated only briefly at the door leading into the spire, steeling himself for what he might find. Then he entered the building and mounted the long spiral staircase leading up to the first floor of the archives. Revan had defeated Mandalore shortly after Mitra's victory at Malachor V, effectively ending the war. Then he and Malak had set off into the unknown regions, while Mitra had returned to face the judgment of the Jedi Council. She hadn't spoken to Revan since. He didn't even know where she was. He knew some of the details of what had happened. On her return, the Jedi Council had declared her a traitor for following Revan. They had stripped her of her rank and banished her, branding her as the Exile. According to the rumors, she had left Republic space and simply disappeared. Yet Revan felt there was more to the story. Mitra hadn't tried to contact him following Malak's defeat. Even if she had left Republic space, she surely would have heard of Revan's redemption by now. The fact that there had been no word from her was disturbing. Once he had tried to reach out to her with the Force. Serving in battle with someone formed a special bond. Even across the breadth of the galaxy, he should have been able to get some vague sense of her presence. Yet he had felt nothing. The simplest explanation was that she had become one with the Force. But Revan couldn't allow himself to believe she was dead. After surviving the horrors of Malachor V, an anonymous death in the Outer Rim simply didn't seem fair. He stepped from the spiral staircase and onto the fourth-story landing, then pushed open the door to the second floor of the archives. He was relieved to see there was nobody else around. He wanted to do his research in private. Passing through the tightly packed stacks of data disks, he took a seat at one of the holo terminals. He wasn't sure exactly what he was looking for, so he simply entered Mitra's name into the index. Several entries came up, including an official report on Malachor V compiled by one of the Jedi archivists. He made a mental note of the reference number, retrieved the data disk from its shelf, and inserted it into the terminal. He spent the next few minutes reviewing the report, but failed to come across anything he didn't already know. Malachor V had been a trap, a ploy to lure the Mandalorian fleet in close enough to the planet to unleash the mass shadow generator, an experimental superweapon that would draw upon the gravitational anomalies unique to the Malachor system to instantaneously destroy every ship orbiting the planet. Revan split his fleet in two, giving command of one half to Mitra. While he led his forces against Mandalore's flagship, he ordered his most trusted general to use her fleet as bait to lure the bulk of Mandalorian ships within range of the mass shadow generator. The Mandalorians had taken the bait, and once they were in range, Mitra gave the order to engage the mass shadow generator. The atmosphere exploded in a flash of fire, leaving only ash behind. Everything on Malachor's surface, every plant and tree, every animal and insect was instantly vaporized by the intense heat. The ground cracked and heaved, leaving deep scars across the blasted landscape. At the same time, hundreds of ships, Republic and Mandalorian alike, were yanked from orbit by the creation of an irresistible gravity vortex at the planet's core. they crashed into the surface of the world, striking with such velocity that their hulls actually penetrated several kilometers into the ground, burying the twisted wreckage and broken bodies. Tens of thousands of lives were snuffed out in a fraction of a second. Revan's and Mitra's ships had both been safely beyond the range of the superweapon, though whether that was by luck or design, Revan honestly couldn't say. His memories of that time were gone, and looking back on his actions, he couldn't fully explain or justify them. Had he known what was going to happen, willingly sacrificing thousands of his own followers to achieve ultimate victory over the Mandalorians? Or had something in the plan gone horribly wrong? The report wasn't so ambiguous. It claimed Revan and Mitra both knew what would happen. It declared them criminals of war and mass murderers. The author of the report speculated that Malachor V was proof that even then Revan had already embraced the ways of the dark side. But Revan wasn't interested in the opinions of some anonymous Jedi archivist. He only cared for the facts, particularly what happened to Mitra after the battle. And here, the report was severely lacking. All he could glean was that she had returned of her own free will to face the Council, which summarily banished her from the Jedi Order and Republic space.
"I should have guessed it was you."
The voice came from behind, sharp with indignation. Revan rose from his chair and turned to face the speaker. She wore the traditional robes of a Jedi archivist, though Revan knew she was in fact a Jedi master. She was young for the position, about Bastila's age, but her hair was platinum white. She had cold blue eyes and a pale complexion that spoke of a life spent inside the archives, well sheltered from the rays of the sun. "Atris," Revan said with a nod and a forced smile, silently cursing. Once a close friend of Mitra's, Atris had refused to join those who had gone to battle the Mandalorians. A staunch traditionalist, she had shared the unfavorable opinion of Revan coming to the older, more conservative masters. Of all the people who could have interrupted his search, he could think of few he wanted to encounter less.
"Still trying to recapture your lost memories?"
she asked a little too smugly. And Revan understood that her arrival was no accident. Atris must have tagged the report he'd been reading, so it would alert her whenever it was referenced. There were no rules or regulations against this kind of security feature, but it was rarely done. As a rule, those who served the Council of First Knowledge respected the right to personal privacy of Jedi visiting the Temple Archives. Yet even though Revan had sought to keep his investigations private, he had done nothing wrong, and he still needed answers. "This report seems to skim over some of the relevant details," he said. "Shoddy work," he added on a sudden hunch. He saw Atris bristle, and he knew he'd guessed right. Not only had she tagged the report, she'd also prepared it.
"Maybe you just can't see the obvious truth in front of you," she snapped.
Revan smiled. Despite all the Jedi teachings about peace and serenity, he'd always had a knack for riling up overly sanctimonious members of the Order like Atris. "Guess I just need your great wisdom to help me understand what I'm missing."
"What makes you think I would do anything to help you?"
"I'm still a Jedi, and Mitra's sentence is a matter of record," he reminded her, suddenly serious. "I have a right to know the truth of what happened. All of it."
"What more is there to tell? She made the mistake of following you. You led her down the path to the dark side. She committed an unforgivable act, and for this the Council banished her."
"It was a desperate act during a desperate time," Revan said. "And the mass shadow generator was an experimental prototype. How could the Council be sure Mitra even knew what would happen? What if it was all a mistake? A terrible accident?"
"The mass shadow generator was a weapon of war,"
Atris replied with a cool, rational calm.
"Its sole purpose was death and destruction, and she gave the order to activate it. How is that an accident?"
"But she obviously regretted her actions, and she surrendered voluntarily to the Council.
Why wouldn't they show her mercy? They needed to make an example of her.
Atrus made no effort to hide the bitterness in her voice.
She became a symbol for all those who had defied the will of the council. Mercy was not an option.
It can't be that simple, Revan pressed. My crimes were far worse, yet the council gave me a second chance.
You could still be of use to us.
Revan sensed there was something she wasn't saying. What does that mean? Mitra was a powerful Jedi. Why didn't the council try to redeem her? The archivist shook her head in disbelief.
You really have no idea what you did to her, do you?
No, I don't, Revan snapped, allowing his frustration to bubble over. My memory has more holes in it than a Kaminoan sponge, so why don't you just tell me? Atrus bit her lower lip and glared at him. Then, perhaps realizing that answering his questions was the quickest way to get him to leave, she began to speak.
Mitra was much closer to the mass shadow generator than you were. She felt the shockwave. It nearly killed her, left her vulnerable. At the same time, she felt the deaths of the Mandalorians and her fellow soldiers through the Force. It was all too much to bear in her weakened state. It would have killed her.
She paused for emphasis before continuing.
Instinctively, she protected herself the only way she knew how. She cut herself off from the Force. Permanently.
I'm sorry, Revan said sincerely. I had no idea.
Really?
Atrus replied angrily.
Then why did you and Malak leave her behind when you went into the unknown regions? You realized she was of no further use to you, and you abandoned her. That's why she came back to the Order to face judgment.
I didn't see that in your report. Is that fact or just speculation? Her refusal to speak was reply enough. Even if what you say is true, Revan continued, I'm not the same man anymore. Is it right to still hold me accountable for those crimes?
A Chalarax can't change its spots, she muttered under her breath.
Revan was too busy trying to process all he had learned to react to her comment. If Mitra was cut off from the Force, that would explain why he hadn't been able to sense her presence. That meant she could still be alive somewhere. She might still know something that could help him understand the meaning of his vision. Do you know where she went? He asked. I need to speak with her.
Haven't you done enough already?
Atrus demanded.
It's your fault she defied the Council and betrayed the Order. It's your fault she fell to the dark side and was branded the Exile. It's your fault she cut herself off from the Force. For a Jedi, that's a fate worse than death.
I've come closer to death than most, Revan countered. And I can assure you that's not true. Atrus snorted in contempt.
That is the difference between us. I live for the Force. You live for yourself.
Revan shrugged, knowing a philosophical argument wasn't going to get him any closer to finding Mitra. Whatever you think of me, he said, I did not compel Mitra into any of this. She made her own choices, and it should be her decision now if she wants to speak to me again, not yours. If you know where she is, you have to tell me.
I haven't spoken to her since her trial,
Atrus answered through gritted teeth, and Revan knew she was telling the truth.
I do not know where she went, and I hope I never see her again. The Exile betrayed the Order, as did you. You're not welcome here. Go back home to your wife.
Atrus spoke the last word with such venom she nearly choked on it. Revan said, wagging his finger at her. There is no emotion. There is peace. Her lip curled up in a snarl, and she spun on her heel and stormed out of the room. Revan waited until the sound of her feet on the stairs faded, then sat slowly back down in the chair. With Atris gone, he could let his sarcastic mask slip. Despite what he'd said to her, he couldn't help but feel responsible for Mitra. He'd refused to give Atris the satisfaction of seeing his guilt and grief, but now that he was alone, the emotions came flooding to the surface. Most of his specific memories of Mitra were gone. He could recall only disjointed bits and pieces, but she had once been one of his closest friends, and he still felt a powerful emotional connection to her. Slumping forward, he buried his face in his hands. He expected tears to follow, but that didn't happen. Instead, he just felt a hollow, numbing sorrow. After several minutes, he took a deep breath to collect himself and rose to his feet. Then he headed out the archive's door and down the stairs. He'd come to the temple in search of an old friend and confidant, hoping she could help him understand the dreams that plagued his nights. Instead, he'd found a dead end and learned the grim truth about the one they called the Exile. "No wonder I never come here anymore," he grumbled under his breath as he made his way across the courtyard and headed for the exit. Chapter 6. A week had passed since the mission on Halion. Daily doses of Colto had healed Scourge's wounds. Even his cracked ribs were fully mended, but his pride and confidence were still wounded. The mission had been a success, but things had gone a lot less smoothly than he would have liked. No doubt Setchel's report to Nyriss would paint each of his mistakes in the most garish tone. He was desperate to find some way to vent his frustrations, and today he had finally felt well enough to visit the Stronghold's exercise yard for a much-needed workout. He rarely went more than 2 or 3 days without practicing his drills, knowing that his continued survival would often depend on his martial expertise. Though there were others in the yard, none was a worthy sparring partner. He would gain little from testing himself against any of Murtaugh's soldiers. Even the guard captain himself wouldn't present any real challenge to a fully trained Sith Lord. Instead, he performed a complex routine of drills designed to hone his reflexes, all while wearing his heavy armor. His crimson blade hummed as he cycled through the aggressive thrusts and cuts of Juyo, the seventh form of lightsaber combat. The weapon moved so fast, it was nothing but a blur, but each strike was precise and controlled. In the middle of his routine, he noticed that Nyriss's young Twi'lek slave had entered the yard. She stood patiently off to one side, her head bowed respectfully. Scourge put an abrupt end to the session, knowing she would be here only if Nyriss had sent her. He flicked his lightsaber off and clipped it to his belt before crossing the yard to her.
"Darth Nyriss wishes to speak to you,"
the Twi'lek said softly, keeping her eyes focused on the ground.
"Will Setchel be there?"
he demanded.
"I do not know, my lord,"
she replied. Scourge frowned. He had not seen or spoken with Setchel since their return.
"Take me to Nyriss."
The slave nodded, then turned and set off. Scourge fell into step behind her. He'd sought Setchel out several times over the past week, but the aide always seemed to be off on some task or assignment. It could have been coincidence, but it was also possible Setchel was avoiding him. If that was the case, Scourge might know why. During his recovery, he'd had plenty of time to think back on the mission. Rehashing it in his head had brought several inconsistencies to light, things Setchel might not want to discuss with Scourge face to face. The slave was leading him through the east wing of the Stronghold. She was moving quickly ahead of him, but with his long legs, Scourge had little trouble keeping up. As he walked, he continued to mull over the issue of Setchel. At the time, he'd credited the aide with saving his life by shutting down the manufacturing plant's power grid and disabling the security droids. Now he wondered if that had been an accident. The more he thought about it, the more the evidence seemed to indicate that Setchell hadn't wanted him to survive the mission. Setchell had obviously needed Scourge's help to get past the drones and the fence outside the plant, and he needed Scourge to hold off security long enough for him to slice into UDM's computer network. But after that, Scourge became expendable. Once the droids were deactivated, Setchell no longer needed the Sith Lord to protect him. What at first sounded like a paranoid fantasy became more and more plausible as Scourge recalled the specific details of the mission. He had no way of knowing how long it had taken Setchell to slice into the network, but he'd likely found the files he was looking for in the first few minutes. Looking back, it seemed as if he could have shut down the power grid much sooner than he had. What if Setchell had waited as long as possible before deactivating the droids, hoping they would have enough time to kill Scourge? From the records room, Setchell couldn't have seen what was happening out on the manufacturing floor. He'd probably assumed Scourge was already dead by the time he shut everything down. That would also explain why Setchell hadn't bothered to contact him with a warning that the plant was about to explode. He'd only mentioned the reactors because Scourge called him on the holocom after everything went dark. If Scourge hadn't initiated the holocall, Setchell might have slipped away in the darkness alone. Setchell's early assurances that UDM didn't have assault droids were also suspect. The units Scourge had encountered could have been experimental prototypes, as Setchell had claimed. But it was also possible he'd known about them all along and hadn't said anything, hoping Scourge would be caught off guard by their arrival. Three pieces of circumstantial evidence: a possible delay in shutting down the droids, Setchell not contacting him to warn about the impending explosion, and the unexpected presence of the assault droids, weren't enough for Scourge to be certain of anything. Yet the fact that Setchell now seemed to be avoiding him further strengthened the Sith Lord's desire to question him in a very long, very private session. Unfortunately, that talk would have to wait. Setchell still enjoyed Nyriss's protection, and Scourge wasn't willing to risk the Dark Counselor's wrath by interrogating him. Not yet, at least. They had reached the door to Nyriss's private chamber. Scourge briefly considered whether he should say something about his suspicions to her, then decided against it. Setchell was an expert at political maneuvering. If he was guilty, involving Nyriss would only work in the advisor's favor. Better to confront him directly when the time was right. The Twi'lek slave knocked lightly on the door, and Nyriss's voice called out,
"Enter!"
from the other side. Once again, Nyriss sat at the computer console in the center of the room. As she rose from her chair and turned to face Scourge, the slave closed the door, sealing the three of them alone in the room.
"I was given word you had recovered from your injuries," Nyriss said.
"Nothing serious, my lord," Scourge replied.
"You seem to have a habit of getting wounded in my service."
"I was surprised by the assault droids."
"And I'm surprised they gave you so much trouble."
Scourge remained silent. Nyriss stretched her dry, cracked lips into an unsettling grin that seemed to fill the entire lower half of her wrinkled face. Scourge endured the rictus without comment until it mercifully faded.
"I find it odd that someone with your reputation would be hard-pressed to defeat a single assault droid and a few patrol drones, yet you dispatched my mercenaries with ease."
It was obvious she was getting at something, but Scourge had no idea what it might be.
I don't understand," he finally admitted.
"No, you don't,"
she agreed, briefly flashing another disconcerting smile.
"Recite the Sith Code for me,"
she instructed, sounding like one of the trainers at the academy.
"Peace is a lie. There is only passion. Through passion I gain strength."
The words came easily to Scourge. The mantra had been drilled into his brain during the training until it was second nature.
Through strength I gain power. Through power I gain victory. Through victory my chains are broken.
You know the words, but you do not truly understand them,
Nyriss admonished.
The dark side draws in the most powerful emotions. Anger, hatred, fear. We are taught to use our emotions to unlock our true potential and unleash the force against our enemies.
Scourge pushed down the impatience threatening to rise within him. She was saying nothing he hadn't heard countless times during his apprenticeship, but she must have a reason he wasn't yet seeing.
The force runs through every living being,
she went on.
When we fight an opponent of flesh and blood, we draw on their emotions as well. All who follow the dark side instinctively do this on some level. It is so instinctive that most instructors feel it does not need to be taught.
She paused, and again he wondered where she was going with all this.
I have studied your records from the academy, and observed your battle with the mercenaries in my courtyard,
she said at last.
You have a special gift. You do not just feed on the raw emotions of your foe. You gorge yourself on them. You feast on their primal fear. It amplifies your hate and anger. It fuels the power of the Force. It transforms you into an instrument of death and destruction.
Scourge nodded. Battling a living foe was intoxicating. With each attack and counter, he felt a rush of heat coursing through his veins, energizing and empowering him. Yet he had felt almost none of that at the UDM plant.
When I fought the security droid, there was nothing to grab onto. It was cold, empty.
Precisely. You tried to feed off its non-existent emotions, and in doing so only made yourself weaker. I wonder that this wasn't observed in you. Even the most powerful gift needs guiding to be used effectively.
She shook her head.
You are so used to using your gift that you neglect the most basic source of power, yourself. The next time you find yourself in a similar situation, you must turn your focus inward. Draw on your own emotions, and you will destroy your mechanical enemies as readily as you slaughter your organic ones.
Scourge nodded. He did not like being lectured, but her observation was a good one. He realized that he had indeed learned to rely on the emotions of his enemies to feed his power, and he had not seen that such a gift could also be a weakness, but one that, with time and practice, could be overcome.
A valuable lesson, my lord, one I will take to heart.
I have enough sycophants working for me,
she answered, brushing off his gratitude.
But none can do what I do,
Scourge reminded her. Nyriss spread her lips into another gruesome smile, and Scourge resisted the urge to shudder as a chill crawled down his spine.
I hope your restored confidence will serve you well on your next mission, she said. The files that you recovered from the UDM proved quite fruitful. He traced the payment for the custom droid sent to assassinate me back to a group of radical human separatists from Bosthirda, dedicated to freeing their world from the tyranny of the Emperor and the Dark Council.
Heavy sarcasm dripped from her voice, and Scourge shared her contempt. There were some enemies he could respect. There were some causes he could understand, even if he fought against them. This was not one of them. There were recently conquered worlds that suffered under the Empire's yoke, planets like Halion, where rebellion was to be expected. But Bosthirda had been part of the Empire for hundreds of years. Its people were full citizens, with all the rights and privileges of those on Dromund Kaas. humans separate as propaganda might cry out against unfair treatment of their species. But Scourge knew their claims were unfounded. The original Dark Jedi who taught the Sith tribes the ways of the Force millennia ago had been human, and though their bloodlines had been absorbed into Sith aristocracy long ago, humans still made up the vast majority of the Imperial population. There were human slaves, of course, but these were individuals born into the lower ranks of society, or those who had fallen through their own failures and weaknesses. Unlike other lesser species, they were not persecuted or discriminated against in any real way. There were no laws limiting their movements, no restrictions on what rank or position they could hold. Humans could rise to the highest ranks of the Imperial military. A number of worlds were even ruled by wealthy and powerful human families, and the Emperor had appointed many humans to serve on the Dark Council. Of the 12 current members, 5 were human, including Darth Zedrix, the counselor with the longest active service. Humans had no right or reason to complain about their status in the Empire. The Separatists were nothing but ungrateful scum and traitors.
"Why did they target you?" Scourge wondered aloud. "Why not strike at the Emperor himself?"
"The Emperor is too well protected," Nyriss said. "Since they cannot get to him, one of the longest-serving members of the Dark Council is the next best thing. And they would never strike at Darth Zedrix," she added. "He is human. They probably consider him one of their own."
"What about Darth Egrol?" Scourge asked. "He is Sith, and he has served longer than anyone except Darth Zedrix."
"Egrol resides on Dromund Fels. Killing one of the Dark Council on Dromund Kos, the Imperial capital, makes more of a statement."
She paused.
"They may also have chosen me because of my history with Darth Zedrix. Ever since I joined the Dark Council, there has been animosity between us. At the time, he was one of the most powerful members. Yet even from the start, he sensed my potential and feared it. For decades, he has schemed against me. But I have outmaneuvered him every time, slowly building up my allies and influence, while his have dwindled away."
Nyriss wasn't telling Scourge anything new. It was common knowledge that members of the Dark Council typically viewed one another as dangerous rivals, and there were always rumors of shadowy feuds being fought behind the scenes. Scourge believed the Emperor actually encouraged the infighting, since it dissuaded the various members from uniting their resources against him. Despite what Nyriss claimed, however, her rivalry with Darth Zedrix had been anything but one-sided. Both had seen their fortunes rise and fall and rise again, with neither able to gain enough of an upper hand to eliminate the other. Somehow Scourge didn't think it would be prudent to mention this.
"The Separatists probably see my rivalry with Darth Zedrix as proof I dislike all humans. Untrue, of course, but a well-crafted lie will often serve where truth will not."
Her logic was sound, but the reasons hardly mattered. The Separatists had tried to kill a member of the Dark Council. There had to be retribution.
"I will find these traitors and eviscerate them," he declared.
"They've already been found. Satchel was able to use the information he acquired at UDM to locate their base in the mountains of Bos Theerda. If they heard about the destruction of the UDM plant, they may be suspicious. We must strike quickly, before they can move to a new location. My people are leaving for Bos Theerda tonight. You will accompany them."
"You're sending Satchel with me again?"
Nyriss nodded.
"They may have connections to other terrorist groups. Satchel will be able to slice their records and find out who they are working with. I'm also sending Murtaugh and his soldiers with you. Satchel will be your precision instrument. The soldiers will be your blunt tool."
Scourge would have preferred to leave Satchel behind, at least until he'd had a chance to confirm his suspicions. He briefly considered sharing his concerns with Nyriss, then decided to stick with his original plan of keeping them to himself. He'd just have to keep a close eye on Setchel during the mission, and be wary of walking into any traps. There would be plenty of time to deal with him once the Separatists were eliminated, and he had proven himself worthy in Darth Nyriss's eyes.
"The human filth will die, my lord," Scourge promised, bowing low. "I will not fail."
Chapter 7.
For the second time in the space of a single month, Revan found himself at a table in the back of the dealer's den, surrounded by the dregs of Coruscant. "You couldn't have just contacted me via holocom?" he asked Candorous as he took a seat. T3 obediently rolled underneath the table to sit patiently at their feet, safely away from where the waitress might trip over him.
"I need to talk to you face to face about this,"
the Mandalorian replied. "Sounds ominous." T3 chirped in agreement.
"You still having those nightmares?"
Candorous asked. "Sometimes. I'm dealing with it." The dreams were coming only two or three times a week now, instead of every night. Revan didn't know if this was because his subconscious was gaining more control over the repressed memory, or if it had something to do with the fact that he was taking steps to investigate his vision. Whatever the explanation, over the past week he had finally been able to grab a few nights of fitful rest. It wasn't enough to get rid of the dark circles under his eyes, but he no longer felt utterly exhausted. "Tell me what you found," he said.
"I didn't learn anything about a planet covered in storms and eternal night, but I did dig up something you might be interested in."
The astromech droid at Revan's feet beeped twice. It was obvious even to him that Candorous was hesitant to speak. "I hope you're not waiting for me to try to buy this information from you," Revan joked. "I left most of my credits at home." Candorous shifted uncomfortably, then leaned forward to speak in a low whisper.
"I probably shouldn't be telling you this, you being a Jedi and all, but I think you have a right to know."
"If you're worried I'll go running to the Council with your secret, don't be."
"It's not just them. You can't tell the Galactic Senate either."
"Whatever you've got to say must be pretty bad," Revan remarked.
"Depends on your point of view."
The big man leaned back in his chair and took a deep breath. Revan stayed silent, giving his friend time to gather himself.
"I got in contact with some of my people, just like you asked,"
Candorous said finally.
"I found out that dozens of the strongest chiefs are gathering their clans at Rekiad."
Revan recognized the name. Located in the Outer Rim system of the same name, Rekiad was a virtually uninhabited world of ice and snow.
"They're planning another invasion?"
he guessed, assuming that was why Candorous was worried about the Jedi or the Republic finding out.
"No, they're not,"
Candorous assured him.
"Not yet, at least. They're searching for Mandalore's mask. They think you hid it somewhere on Rekiad."
An image flickered through Revan's mind. He and Malak standing on the top of a glacier, surrounded by a swirling blizzard. It vanished before he could grasp it, retreating into the dark corners of his subconscious. Yet the brief flash of the resurfacing memory was enough to confirm what Candorous had said.
"I think they may be right,"
Revan muttered. Candorous was silent, obviously expecting him to say more, but there wasn't anything he could add. The memory was gone.
"You know what that mask means to my people," Candorous said. "Without it, we are lost. Vagabonds wandering the galaxy without a purpose. Recovering the mask could be the key to restoring Mandalorian honor and power."
Revan knew all this. That was why he had hidden the mask after slaying Mandalore the Ultimate, a final act to demoralize a defeated foe. He'd hoped it would take the Mandalorians generations to recover from the loss of their most revered cultural symbol. Without it, the warlike clans would be too busy fighting among themselves for power to even think about conquering Republic worlds. But if the mask were to be found again...
Whoever finds it will be hailed as the new leader of the clans,
Candorous continued.
Mandalore will rise again, and the Mandalorians will follow.
Revan knew that Candorous was sharing this knowledge with him out of loyalty. They had been through too many battles together for him to keep this secret. Yet he also understood why Candorous had been reluctant to speak. He was still a Mandalorian, and he feared for the future of his people. The wounds of the Mandalorian Wars were still fresh in the minds of the Jedi and the Republic. The looming specter of a Mandalorian army unified by a single warlike leader would not be ignored. Even if the Jedi Council refused to take action again, the Senate would send its fleets to crush the potential threat before it could begin. In their disorganized and depleted state, it was unlikely the Mandalorians would be able to resist. After the inevitable defeat, the Senate would likely impose martial law over the surviving clans, forcing them to disarm and abandon the customs and practices of their warrior culture. If the Republic found out about this, the Mandalorians, as Candorous knew them, would cease to exist forever. Do you believe the Mandalorians will attack the Republic again if the mask is found? Revan asked.
Depends who finds it,
Candorous answered candidly.
Some of the clan leaders want nothing more than to avenge our defeat. Others would rather try to rebuild our society. We were great warriors before we started conquering Republic worlds. It's possible we can restore our honor without violating the treaty terms we agreed to.
The terms I forced you to accept, Revan thought. It was ironic that Candorous was sharing all this with the architect of the Mandalorians' greatest defeat. Almost a decade earlier, Revan had been one of the few willing to take action against the invading clans. But he was not the same person he was back then. He no longer clung to the simplistic ideals of right and wrong or good and evil. He understood better than anyone that dark and light were intertwined in strange and complex ways. And on some primal level, he knew this was all somehow connected to his visions of a dark, storm-swept world. The Mandalorians had the potential to be a very real threat, but his visions had convinced him there was something far more dangerous lurking beyond the borders of known space. The fate of the entire galaxy might rest on the repressed memories trying to break free from the prison of his own mind. And sending a hostile Republic fleet to scatter the clans wouldn't get him any closer to unlocking the truth. I'm not going to say anything about this to the Senate or the Council, Revan assured his friend. But whoever finds the Mandalore's mask will shape the destiny of your people for the next 1,000 years. I think it might be a good idea for us to be there when that happens. A broad grin spread across Candorous's scarred, square jaw, and he reached across the table and slapped the Jedi on the shoulder.
Oh, I knew I could count on you. Time to get the old gang back together for one last adventure.
Not everyone, Revan countered. Juhani and Jolie are Jedi. They still answer to the Council. They might feel obligated to say something about this.
I got no problem with leaving the cat girl and the old man behind.
I don't want to get Mission and Zalbar mixed up in this either, Revan continued. They've worked hard to build up a nice import-export business over the past year. I don't want them to throw it all away.
They would if you asked them to, Candorous noted. Wouldn't even think twice about it.
That's why I'm not going to ask. Mission's had it rough her whole life. Now that she's finally got it back on track, I'm not going to mess things up for her.
Okay, scratch the Twi'lek kid. But what about Zalbar? That Wookiee knows how to handle himself when things get rough.
Mission and Big Z are a team. We can't break them up. Candorous rolled his eyes.
We're getting a little short on bodies here.
T3 whistled loudly, and Revan reached down to give him a reassuring pat on the head.
Don't worry, little fella. You're too useful to leave behind.
The astromech droid whistled again.
Good point, Revan replied. HK's a little too trigger-happy to bring on this mission. Things tend to get bloody when he's around.
You realize we're going to a planet overrun with Mandalorians,
Candorous reminded him.
Bloody is probably unavoidable.
I'm hoping at least some of the clans can be reasoned with,
Revan explained.
If we bring a homicidal assassin droid with us, I don't think they're going to give us much of a chance to explain why we're there.
We're a little short on bodies, Candorous
repeated.
What about that other Jedi who helped you during the war? Not Melek, the one they call the Exile.
Mitra, Revan said.
I heard she and the Council had a falling out.
I don't know where she is.
Might be worth tracking her down,
Candorous pressed.
She proved herself during the war.
Revan wasn't sure how much Candorous knew about Malachor V and the mass shadow generator. The mission report was sealed away in the Jedi archives. He might have no idea that she had lured thousands of his fellow soldiers into a trap. It was also possible he was fully aware of Mitra's actions and respected her even more for making the ruthless but tactically brilliant decision to sacrifice thousands of her own people to achieve victory. In either case, Revan didn't want to get into the tragic tale of Mitra's banishment and her severance from the Force.
She may have had a falling out with the Council, but she's still a Jedi,
he lied, doing his best to ignore the twinge of guilt he felt for his role in her ultimate fate.
So who's that leave, then? You, me, and this half-sized bucket of boats?
Candorous gave T3 a playful kick with one of his heavy boots. The droid beeped angrily in response.
Don't forget Bastila, Revan added.
I thought you wanted to leave the Jedi out of this.
She's my wife, Revan answered. I'm not going to abandon her.
Hey, it's your call,
Candorous said, holding his hands up defensively.
She's welcome to come along.
I mean, if you really think you could convince her that heading out to the Outer Rim to explore Rekied's frozen wastelands is a good idea. Well, Revan said with a shrug, we never did go on a honeymoon.
Bastila was sitting in the living room when he got home, watching holovids while she waited for him to return. Revan wondered if she'd been waiting long. He hadn't told her where he was going, and he hadn't told her about sending Candorous off to investigate the Mandalorians. He just hadn't seen any point in worrying her if there was nothing she could do to help. Now that they had a plan, however, he was eager to share it with her. He just had to be careful how he explained it all.
Sorry, he said as he crossed the room and bent down to give her a kiss. I didn't know I'd be so late. You shouldn't have waited up.
That's okay,
she said, taking his hand and pulling him down onto the couch beside her.
I couldn't sleep.
Still holding his hand, she turned to face him.
I've got something to tell you,
she said.
Me too. Big news.
I bet mine is bigger,
she said with a faint smile.
That's a bet you'd lose, he warned her.
I'm pregnant.
Revan was stunned into silence for several long seconds. When he finally managed to speak, all he could say was,
okay, you win.
Revan couldn't believe he hadn't noticed Bastila's pregnancy earlier. Though there were no visible physical signs of her condition, it should have been obvious. The instant she'd told him, he'd clearly sensed the life growing inside her through the Force.
I must be getting senile in my old age, he said, caressing her still flat belly.
You've had a lot on your mind,
Bastila reminded him.
And you haven't been sleeping much.
It was still too early to tell if it was a boy or girl, but it didn't matter to Revan either way. He and Bastila were going to have a child, It was the happiest day of his life. There was just one small problem.
Talk about bad timing,
Bastila murmured, echoing his own sentiments. Once he'd gotten over the joyful shock of her news, he told her about his meeting with Candorous.
I have to do this, he said softly. It's the only way I'm ever going to find out what that vision actually means.
What if you don't find out?
Bastila countered.
Your nightmares are fading. Maybe in a few months they'll stop.
Maybe, he agreed, though he didn't believe it. But I think these are more than just old memories bubbling up. They're a warning. Even if the vision stopped, the threat they represent would still be out there.
Haven't you done enough already?
Bastila asked, her voice rising slightly.
You saved the Republic from the Mandalorians. You saved the Republic from Malak, and in return you had your identity destroyed and were ostracized by the Council.
She pulled away from him, her anger building.
You don't owe them anything anymore,
she insisted.
You've paid for your mistakes. You've sacrificed enough. You've earned the right to live out your days in peace.
If I don't do something, nobody else will, he said, shaking his head.
So what? So nobody does anything. Whatever evils lurking in the unknown regions might not show itself for decades. We could both be old and gray by then. We have a chance to live out our entire lives in perfect happiness. Are you willing to risk throwing all that away?
It was tempting to give in. It would be easy to pretend nothing was wrong and just live in blissful ignorance, like trillions of other beings in the galaxy. There was only one problem with her argument.
I'm not doing this for the Republic, he explained. I'm not doing it for you. I'm not even doing it for me. I'm doing it for our child. And our child's children. We might never live to see the horrors that are coming, but they will.
He tightened his arm around her.
We have to protect the Republic for them. We have to risk our chance at happiness, so they can have a life we might never know.
Bastila didn't answer. Instead, she leaned against him, resting her head on his shoulder. And he knew she felt the same way.
When do we leave?
She asked after a long moment of silence.
You can't come with me,
Revan objected gently.
What if I find something on Rekiat? Some clue connected to my past? What if it leads me farther into the Outer Rim, or even the unknown regions? We could be gone for months, maybe longer. Do you really want to give birth on some uninhabited world on the edges of the galaxy? And then what will we do? How are we going to care for an infant under those conditions? I won't risk the life of our child like that. And I know you won't either.
Bastila reached two fingers up and pressed them gently against Revan's lips.
If I say you're right,
she whispered,
will you please shut up?
He nodded silently.
Because I can think of better things to do on the last night before you leave than talking.
Revan couldn't have agreed with her more. Bastila accompanied Revan and T3 to the spaceport. Candorous was already there, loading supplies onto the Ebon Hawk. The Ebon Hawk had served Revan well during his hunt for Darth Malak. Owned by a succession of smugglers and pirates, it was one of the fastest ships in the galaxy. It had enough room to comfortably accommodate a crew of 8 with cargo and supplies, yet a single individual could pilot it when necessary. Technically speaking, the Ebon Hawk still belonged to Davik Kang, a Teresian crime lord. But Davik wouldn't be coming to reclaim it. He was long dead, his body buried beneath the ruins of Terrace when Malak bombed the city world from orbit.
Be careful out there,
Bastila said.
I always am,
he answered with a smile, wiping a single tear from the corner of her eye. They didn't need to say anything else. They'd said their true goodbyes in private the previous night. Bastila's years of Jedi training had left her uncomfortable with public displays of emotion. But she'd stood up on her toes and planted a long, hard kiss on Revan's lips. Then she turned away and quickly left the spaceport. Candorous raised a curious eyebrow, but showed enough restraint not to ask why she wasn't coming. They finished loading the ship in silence. 20 minutes later, the Ebon Hawk took flight. Chapter 8. Bos Theerda's orange sun was setting quickly. Scourge, crouched in the shadows of a cramped alley in the warehouse district on the outskirts of Jurunga, the planetary capital, watched it disappear. As darkness fell, the photosensitive street lamps kicked in, casting the entire district in a pale yellow glow. The dim artificial illumination was enough to give Scourge a clear view of the two-story building across the street. From the outside, there was no way to tell that the structure was the Separatist base. There were no autoguns on the roof. No guards patrolled the perimeter. The loading bay doors were ordinary Durasteel, rather than the reinforced kind used to construct blast doors. The windows were blacked out, and several security cams panned back and forth, surveying the street, but neither was unusual for buildings in this district. Instead of military fortifications that might draw unwarranted attention, the Separatists relied on anonymity and secrecy to protect them. They would be unprepared for the wrath about to rain down upon them. His comlink beeped softly, followed by Murtaugh's whispered voice.
Team is in position.
Hold until my signal, Scourge replied. Give me time to take out those cams.
Could be droids in there,
Setchel chimed in.
You sure you don't want Murtaugh's team to go in first and clear the way?
Scourge gritted his teeth. Did Setchel know about Scourge's difficulties in taking down the droids at the UDM plant? Were his words a way of saying, I know your secrets, I know your weaknesses? On the other hand, if Setchel was just making a joke based on what had happened on their last mission, then Scourge's paranoid overanalysis meant that the slimy little sycophant had gotten to him. Neither option sat well with the Sith Lord, particularly since he still wasn't sure whether Setchel was trying to get him killed.
Remember the plan, Scourge snapped. The two of you stay back until I give the all clear. We can't risk a stray blaster bolt taking out our Lord's favorite advisor. Leave the dirty work to me and your team.
Understood,
Murtaugh agreed. Keeping Murtaugh out of the battle wasn't the best tactical choice, but it was worth it to keep Setchel away from the action. Scourge didn't need to be looking over his shoulder while he was fighting the Separatists. Plus, Murtaugh would be at a safe distance as well, just in case he turned out to be a co-conspirator.
I'll send the signal once I poke out their eyes, Scourge said, rising to his feet.
Careful to stay in the shadows, Scourge crossed the street to the building adjacent to the base and crept around the back. There he located the utility ladder running up the side of the building and climbed to the rooftop, from which he could look down on the roof of the Separatist base. The gap between the buildings was substantial, nearly 10 meters. Scourge measured the distance, took a dozen steps back, then ran to the edge and leapt over the precipice. He pulled his knees up and tucked into a forward roll as he landed, then sprang to his feet, lightsaber drawn and ready. There were 4 cams on the roof, mounted on poles at each corner. In rapid succession, he reached out with the Force and snapped them off one by one, sending them tumbling from their perches to shatter on the street below.
Target is blind. Move in,
he said into his comlink. In the street below, small squads of Murtaugh's soldiers were approaching the building. Scourge waited while they launched their first volley of flash and stun grenades, followed by a round of suppressing fire as the soldiers took cover positions near the door. From inside came the sound of blaster carbines as the Separatists returned fire. Moving quickly but calmly, Scourge crossed the rooftop to the hatch built into the center. A few seconds later, it swung open, and a pair of Separatists emerged, snipers coming to the roof to take a position on the attackers below. Scourge hacked down the first with his lightsaber, then grabbed the second by the scruff of his collar and yanked him off his feet. The young human looked at him with abject horror, his panic so great that he never even thought to raise his weapon. The Sith Lord fed on the man's fear, savoring it as the heat of the dark side rushed through.